White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Welcome to episode 36 of our study hour on February 28, 2013. Gee, 2 months of the year have passed already. I'm Carolyn Yeager and...
Hadding Scott.
Okay, and folks, tonight we will continue with Chapter 31, The Jewish Aspect of the Movie Problem. And begin chapter 32, no doubt we will, which is titled Jewish Supremacy in the Motion Picture World. These are the two chapters that deal with the Jewish takeover of the movies in America, which follow the three chapters we already did on the American theater. Now, to review what Hadding read last week, I will give you this. It started with an emphasis on the fight against public lewdness, and that it was Jews who sought to profit from commercializing sex and vice. The Oriental, that is otherwise Semitic, idea and the Anglo-Saxon American idea were contrasted. There were protests from the good people of the public, but it was also true that pandering to the lowest instincts of human nature brought financial success to the producers. And a movie critic in Brooklyn wrote, that a decent photoplay, that's what they used to call them, movies, photoplays, brings gross returns of, say, $100,000, while a successful sex play brings from $250,000 to $2.5 million. Jews respond to all protests as due to morbidity, jealousy, or, as we hear now, they said, anti-Semitism. It mentions the National Board of Review of Motion Pictures, and but they don't seem to, I don't know, that was, they don't seem to have a whole lot of influence or whatever, but they don't, they talk about some congressional hearings in this further what we're going to read tonight, but don't really mention this body again. Here's a quote here. If the Jews would throw out of their camp the men and methods that so continuously bring shame upon the Jewish name, this fight for decency could be conducted without so much racial reference. So I thought, gee, that's pretty wild. What do you think of that? If the Jews would... Well, they're saying, here you go again, you know, that all these better Jews, you know, decent Jews should get rid of the... these Jews that are causing the trouble, and then things would be better, and there we wouldn't have to refer to race so much when talking about them. So we're going to hear more about the racial stuff at the end of this chapter. And he said that an analysis of the motion picture industry in the United States will show that 90% of production of pictures is in the hands of 10 large concerns located in New York City and Los Angeles, and that 85% of these large concerns are in the hands of Jews. Then they finally say that all public taste is cultivated, and the Jews have so demoralized the public that producers now can confidently claim that the public demands what we are giving it. So that's where we ended up in this really good chapter 31. I really like these two chapters. We're going to have a lot of fun with them. Okay.
It's getting into things that are still very relevant.
Yes, that's it. Okay, Hadding.
Cocaine peddlers can easily establish a public demand for their drugs, and they do. But that demand is never considered to be an extenuation for the peddling of coke. So with the psychic poison and visual filth of the ordinary movie, the demand it has created is morally lawless, and the further satisfaction of the demand is morally lawless too. Carl Laemmle, one of the leading producers in America and head of the motion of the Universal Film Company, testified before a congressional committee that he had sent a circular entitled, "What Do You Want?" to the exhibitors who bought his pictures. At that time, his company was in communication with about 22,000 exhibitors. Mr. Laemmle says that he expected about 95% of the answers to favor clean, wholesome pictures. But instead of finding 95% favoring clean pictures, I discovered that at least one half, or possibly 60%, want pictures to be risque, the French for smutty. Laemmle himself is a German-born Jew, and did not state what parentage or what percentage of the replies were from people of what is euphemistically termed his faith.
You know, I just want to say here that I'm really happy to see them use the phrase German-born Jew rather than German Jew, which yeah. most people will use. And I've noticed that here, you know, these guys writing this, they're really on top of things. They're pretty darn good. So that's all.
It is a very noticeable fact that whenever any attempt is made to control the tumultuous indecency and triviality which the movies ceaselessly pour out day and night upon the American public, the opposition thereto is Jewish. Take, for example, the attempt to arouse the sober spirit of America to a proper appreciation of what is happening to Sunday, the day of rest. The opponents of the whole movement, a movement for the awakening of conscience, not for the passage of laws, are Jews, and they justify their opposition on Jewish grounds. Yeah, actually, that's the main reason why the ACLU was formed, was for the overturning of what they used to call the blue laws, which forbade people from doing business on Sunday.
That was a big deal, and it's going to be coming up in future chapters where they talk about, that's the part that I have already read. It's really good how they start out and they went after all these kind of things. And having Sunday as a day where there was no business taking place was a big one. Here they were. They just can't allow anything that has any Christian basis to it. And I did not know that it was the ACLU that was opposing that.
I believe the ACLU was formed for that issue.
Wow. Wow. That's very interesting.
That's my recollection. Whenever the movies are before the bar of public opinion, their defenders, as they are Jews. In the congressional hearing before referred to, the lawyers who appeared for the companies were all Jews, distinguished by the names Myers, Ludwig, Kolm, Friend, and Rosenthal.
Now, I have to also say, they use Friend here. You know, we've talked about that name, and I was quite amazed to see that they used Friend as one of the Jewish names.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Any kind of self-flattering name they will use. There was even a Jewish rabbi involved who gave a most ingenuous explanation both of Jewish control of the movies and also of Jewish opposition to control of the character of the movies. "I am a Jew," he said. "You know as well as I do that we have been the unfortunate victims of the nasty biting tongue, and you know as well as I do that the movie first held us up to ridicule, and we have not only been disgraced in these movies, but we have had our religion traduced, and disgracefully traduced." If this is true, it is chargeable to the Jews themselves, for Jews have always controlled this business. That it is true is probable, for the most zealous lampooners of the Jews have been Jewish comedians. Non-Jews fail abjectly in endeavoring to portray the character of the Jews. I hope I'm not failing abjectly anyway.
Yeah, no, keep going. You're doing good.
We felt very much hurt, he continued, and we felt there was a remedy. And that remedy was public opinion. And what did we do? We did not come to Congress. We organized a society, the Independent Order of B'nai B'rith, which is the largest Jewish fraternal order in the world. It organized what is called the Anti-Defamation League, with headquarters in Chicago, and the League for the Defense of the Jewish Name, united with other people in the Catholic Church, the Truth Society, and Holy Name Society. And it wrote to all the movie manufacturers of the country, asking them that they do not traduce the Jewish character and the Jewish religion, and that they do not hold us up to ridicule. That we did not object to the depiction of Jewish character, but we did object to the caricature of Jewish character and the caricature of our name and religion. And after thus having explained to the manufacturers our position, we appointed a committee of men in every city in the country, asking them that they appeal to the municipal authorities that they permit not the presentation of pictures that were calculated to offend the Jewish character and the Jewish sensitiveness. What has been the result? There has been necessary, not a protest, because movies in this country are not producing that class of movies any longer. Of course, there are excellent reasons why the Jewish protests, if any were really necessary, should be instantly obeyed. But why has not the continued and clamorous protest of decent America been equally heeded? Why not? Because the protest has come largely from non-Jews. If the Jews can control the movies to the extent the rabbi claimed, why cannot they control them for decency? Why do they not control them for decency? The one weakness of the rabbi's statement is the charge that the Jewish religion was traduced. It would be most interesting to learn how this was done, and by whom. It is a religion which does not easily lend itself to that sort of treatment, picturesque as some of its forms may appear to alien eyes. There is, however, a meaning hidden in this statement of the rabbi. The Jew considers any public expression of Christian character as being derogatory to his religion. For example, if the President of the United States or the governor of your state should make a specifically Christian allusion in his Thanksgiving proclamation or mention the name of Christ, that act would be protested as offensive to Jewish sensitiveness. Not only would be done, but has been done.
Yeah, it's shocking. You know, that is really something that I don't know how they get away with that. There's just not enough people are, you know, standing up against it. And at that time, they were doing it a lot. They were running around defending themselves, stopping everybody from saying anything about Jews. And then whenever there was anything, just ordinary Christian holidays or things that were done or, you know, things that were statements that were made, they would protest them. Mm-hmm. As, you know, well, that's that ACLU again, which functioned in that way, to make everybody equal or something, or to, you know, to not have religion. Yeah, that's what the ACLU basically was. It was separation of church and state.
Yeah.
In using it to, in order to say, well, there can't be any kind of religious allusions anywhere in anything that has to do with government. And that was mostly Christian, naturally. So that's that.
Yeah. Well, you know, any kind of straight representation of the Gospels is going to be seen as anti-Semitic. Mel Gibson had to take a line out of his Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
The Jews say his blood be on us.
Yeah. Yeah, he did. Was he fighting that? I can't remember. Did he fight that for a while and finally give up?
There was a lot of controversy, but he ended up taking that line out.
Yeah. So there you go.
Even though it's in the Gospels.
Well, we should do the same thing, but we're too tolerant to do that.
Yeah.
In the same hearing referred to, quotation was made from a letter written by Carl H. Pierce, special representative of the Olive Morosco Photoplay Company, to the executive secretary of the Motion Picture Board of Trade, in which the following statement appeared. From Carl H. Pierce. You and I have seen boards turn down such plays as The Life of the Savior because they thought it might offend the Hebrews. Well, there you go. That's just what I said.
Well, yeah, and I think this guy worked for this Oliver Morosco Photoplay Company, was Jewish, even though I don't know that this guy was one of their...
It is apparent.
It's just shocking that that right off the bat, before it even happens, they say, oh, we can't do this because the Jews are going to be offended. So they don't even start doing it.
Yeah. It is apparent that Jewish sensitiveness is a spoiled child, which has been unduly coddled, and that it has interfered to such an extent that the real question becomes one of non-Jewish rights. The Jewish defenders have been asking, why should a nation of 110 million people be considered in danger from 3 million Jews? And Gentile fronts, with all the zest of a new idea, have shouted the same challenging question. It might be advantageous to answer thus. Why should a country of 110 million people, mostly of Christian faith and practice, be prevented from seeing the life of the Savior portrayed on the screen because it is feared to offend the Jews? The answer in both cases is not a comparison of numbers, but a recognition of the fact that, as in the motion picture world, the Jews are at the neck of the bottle, where they can absolutely control what goes to the public. So they are in other fields at corresponding places of control. But whether the Jewish producer is qualified to do better than he is doing is a question. When you consider the conditions from which many of them sprang, you will be rendered rather hopeless of voluntary reform.
That's right.
Why were not Way Down East and The Shepherd of the Hills put on the screen by Jews? Because the Jews, in control of the movies, have no knowledge of American rural life, and therefore no feeling for it. And by the way, those movies, Way Down East was a D.W. Griffith production, film. From 1920, and The Shepherd of the Hills is from 1919. That's directed by Harold Bell Wright.
Huh. Gentiles and the Jews would not put them on their screens, huh? In their theaters or something? They wouldn't.
Well, I'm not sure what he means. He says that those films were not put on the screen by Jews.
They were shown.
Because you can find the movie poster for Way Down East online.
Well, you know, they might go that far, and then a lot of theaters won't put it up. It might be. You'd have to look into that.
I think he just means that the Jews didn't make that film.
Oh, weren't created by Jews. Okay, yeah.
The Jew is a product of city life, and that peculiar phase of city life, which is found in the ghetto. He sees in a farmer only a hick and a rube. You may rest entirely assured that it was not the Yankee, himself a product of the farms, who turned the agriculturalist into a joke. Until today, the joke has emptied our farms of men. The theatrical hick and rube of the gold brick story and the hayseed play were of Jewish origin. The Jew is a product of city life, and of that phase of city life where the wits play a large part. The America of the average Jew who caters to the entertainment of Americans is comprehended in a beaten path from the box office to backstage and thence to an eating place. He doesn't know America as yet, except as a huge aphis which he may milk. It follows, therefore, that in all probability he is equally ignorant of American home life. He has not, as yet, been able to understand what American domesticity means. The American home is an almost unknown quantity to foreigners of the Eastern races. An Armenian woman who has lived in America for 5 years says that she knows nothing of an American home, save what she can see through the windows as she passes. This, of course, is a lack not easily to be bridged over. It may not be strictly true that the majority of movie producers do not know the interiors of American homes, but there is certainly every indication that they have not caught its spirit, and that their misrepresentation of it is more than a false picture. It is also a most dangerous influence. It is dangerous to foreigners who gain their most impressive ideas of American life from the stage. It is dangerous to Americans who fancy that the life of the screen is the life that is lived by the better classes. If we could map the community mind of whole sections of our cities and trace the impressions of American people, American habits, and American standards which those mind groups hold, we should then see the dangerous misrepresentation which movie producers have given to things American. Falsity, artificiality, criminality, and jazz are the keynotes of the mass of screen productions.
It's so funny how Henry Ford just has this thing for jazz, you know, this dislike thing so much that they bring it in all the time. I don't know. They just do that to make him happy, or if he suggested it.
Well, if he liked fiddle music, he may not have liked jazz.
This fiddle music is energizing. I'm so glad we have it at the beginning of the program. It puts me in a good mood immediately. And jazz, which I always liked, but it makes you very languorous and laid back in a way that's, you're too open to almost anything, you know.
Oh,
so it is a very bad influence, even though it sounds good.
So jazz music sort of dismantles your psychic defenses.
There you go. Very well put.
An interesting claim. American life is bare and meager to the Eastern mind. It is not sensuous enough. It is devoid of intrigue. Its women of the homes do not play continuously and hysterically on the sex motif. It is a life made good and durable by interior qualities of faith and quietness. And these, of course, are ennui and death to the orientally minded. There lies the whole secret of the movie's moral failure. They are not American, and their producers are racially unqualified to reproduce the American atmosphere. An influence which is racially, morally, and idealistically foreign to America has been given the powerful projecting forces of the motion picture business, and the consequences are what we see.
You know, now here's, I think this might be the first one, anyway, unless there was one before, but no, right up above, there's two racially in this paragraph, and they start using that word racial and here at the end, and also when they say that, you know, today, we don't even notice that in the movies. We think that the movies, we wouldn't say the movies are not American, because American doesn't mean today what it meant then. America is multicultural, and all this stuff in the movies is like, well, this is America. Where at that time, they were looking at things that weren't anything like what we see, but still, you know, lots of sex and stuff and going on actually in all these B movies that they were making tons of, and saying, you know, that this was not American, which was more clean cut and Puritanish.
Okay.
Supposedly. Okay.
The purpose of this and succeeding articles is not to lift hands in horror and point out how rotten the movies are. Everybody is doing that. The case against the movies is not contested at all. It is unanimous. Women's clubs, teachers, newspaper editors, police officers, judges of the courts, ministers of religion, physicians, mothers and fathers. Everybody knows just what the movies are. What all these disgusted groups evidently do not know is this. Their protests will be entirely useless until they realize that behind the movies there is another group of definite moral and racial complexion, to whom the protest of non-Jews amounts to next to nothing at all, if they can possibly circumvent it. As the rabbi previously quoted above, quoted showed, the Jews got what they wanted from the producers as soon as they made their request. What have the non-Jewish teachers, women's clubs, newspaper editors, police officers and judges, ministers of religion, physicians, and just plain parents of the rising generation? What have they obtained for all their complaints and protests? Nothing. And they can go on beating the air for a lifetime and still obtain no improvement unless they face the unpleasant racial fact that the movies are Jewish. It is not a question of morals. That question has been settled. It is a question of management. When the people know who and what is this intangible influence we call the movies, the problem may not appear so baffling.
Well, that's a great ending to that chapter. You know, yeah. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I hope everybody got that. We've got more listeners than usual listening to us live, Hattie, which is good. And this was in the Dearborn Independent issue of February 12, 1921. And we're going on to another really good chapter. And let's just, instead of talking, me talking, let's just move on to it. And we've got a half hour. We just might
All right.
At least most of it finished.
Chapter 32, Jewish Supremacy in Motion Picture World. A little who's who in the motion picture industry would make a valuable department in the movie theater's printed programs, but it is not pleasant to think of what would happen to the manager who should print one. There is a strange confusion in the Jewish mind, a struggle between a desire to remain unidentified and a desire to be known. Sometimes they measure friendship by the depth of the silence about their being Jews. Sometimes by the amount of open laudation. To say a man is a Jew is sometimes to be vilified as an anti-Semite, and sometimes to be honored as a friend of our nation.
That's really great, you know, saying that you can't get it right, you know. I mean, it's up to them how they want to look at it. You know, if you speak about a Jew in the way they don't like, well, you're an anti-Semite. If you speak about a Jew, of course, you know, honoring them, then that's fine. Otherwise, you should not use the word Jew. It's just, you know, they got all these rules that they managed to enforce.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
In what is said now, the only purpose is to inform movie fans of the source of the entertainment which they crave, and the destination of the millions of dollars which they spend. When you see millions of people crowding through the doors of the movie houses at all hours of the day and night, literally an unending line of human beings in every habitable corner of the land, it is worth knowing who draws them there, who acts upon their minds while they quiescently wait in the darkened theater, and who really controls this massive bulk of human force and ideas generated and directed by the suggestions of the screen? Who stands at the apex of this mountain of control? It is stated in the sentence, the motion picture influence of the United States and Canada is exclusively under the control, moral and financial, of the Jewish manipulators of the public mind.
You know, back then, from the early 1920s through that decade, I was looking up some stuff from then. People were just enamored with these movies, and of course, they weren't as long. A lot of them. How long were they? I don't know. They weren't that. They didn't have such length to them. But people would go to the cinema 3 or 4 times a week, and then they said that housewives would go in the afternoon, again at night, and working people would go at lunch hour, and then they'd go back, after work. And people were just going to see all these movies because there was actually a lot of them. Yeah. They weren't very good, I guess. But
there were some films that were quite long.
Yeah, I know. You're right. But these must have been, some of these silent films were not so long, were they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jews did not invent the art of motion photography. They have contributed next to nothing to its mechanical or technical improvement. They have not produced any of the great artists, either writers or actors, which have furnished the screen with its material. Motion photography, like most other useful things in the world, is of non-Jewish origin. But by the singular destiny which has made the Jews the great cream skimmers of the world, the benefit of it has gone not to the originators, but to the usurpers, the exploiters. Who is who in the motion picture world? The names of the leading producing companies are widely known. The famous players, Selznick, Selwyn, Goldwyn, Fox Film Company, the Jesse L. Lasky Feature Play Company, United Artists Corporation, the Universal Film Company, the Metro, Vitagraph, Seligs, Thomas H. Ince Studios, Artcraft, Paramount, and so on. The famous players is headed by Adolf Zukor. Mr. Zukor is a Hungarian Jew. He was a fur dealer in Hester Street, and is said to have gone from house to house selling his goods. With his first savings, he went into the nickel theater business with Marcus Lowe. He is still in his 40s and immensely wealthy. He is conceded to be the leader of the fifth largest industry in the world, an industry which is really the greatest educational and propagandist device ever discovered. The reader will not be deceived by the use of the word educational in this connection. Movies are educational, but so are schools of crime. It is just because the movies are educational in a menacing way that they come in for scrutiny. Zucker's control extends over such well-known names as famous players Lasky Corporation, the Oliver Morosco Photoplay Company, Paramount Pictures Corporation, Artcraft Pictures, all of which have been absorbed within the past 5 years. It is commonly supposed that the United Artists Corporation is a non-Jewish concern, but according to an article in the American Hebrew, the head of this photoplay aggregation is Hiram Abrams. The United Artists Corporation was formed several years ago by the Big Four among the actors: Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, Charlie Chaplin, and David Wark Griffith. And notwithstanding the fact that Charlie Chaplin is a Jew, the company was regarded by the public as being non-Jewish. And, of course, Chaplin was not a Jew. However, Douglas Fairbanks was.
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
How much Jewish was he?
He seems to have been completely Jew. His father's name was Ullman, and his mother's last name was Marsh, which is very often a Jewish name.
But anyway, it's been pretty much demonstrated that they
were Jewish.
It's
in Wikipedia.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. What do you know?
I think I've read that Mary Pickford was Jewish too, but I think that's in Rockwell's book, White Power, but online it says that she's Irish descent. So I don't think, you know, he went a little too far on some of those things. So she may not have been Jewish. So anyway, Douglas Fairbanks in this group of four was a Jew. Charlie Chaplin allowed people to think that he was a Jew because it was good for his career. Mm-hmm. That's what Wilmot Robertson says. Anyway, Hiram Abrams is a former Portland, Oregon newsboy and graduated from that wholesome occupation into the position of manager of a penny arcade. He was one of the founders of the Paramount Pictures Corporation and became its president. The Fox Film Corporation and the Fox Circuit of Theaters are under control of another Hungarian Jew who is known to the American public as William Fox. His original name is said to have been Fuchs. He also began his artistic and managerial career by running a penny arcade. The penny arcade of 15 and 20 years ago, that would be around 1900, as most city-bred men will remember, was a peep show whose lure was lithographed lewdness, but which never yielded quite as much pornography as it promised.
Yeah, you know, they had all this stuff going on, and, you know, it was, well, you know, you went behind a curtain and you watched and you looked at these pictures, and then God knows, you know, we know what people were doing behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that was that. It was all, you know, legal, but not respectable. But, you know, what caught me is that there's so many Hungarian Jews, and I thought, with all these Hungarian Jews in Hollywood, no wonder we have the fable of the 400,000 gassed Hungarian Jews later on in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. They are pretty big in making films about it, and, you know, I think. Anyway.
All right. 15 years ago, William Fox was in the clothes sponging business. He also is still in his early 40s, is immensely wealthy, and one of the men who can pretty nearly determine what millions of movie fans shall think about certain fundamental things, what ideas and visions they shall entertain. Marcus Lowe also reached fame via the penny arcade and cheap variety vaudeville routes. He went into pictures and is said now to be the active head of 68 companies in various parts of the world. He is in the neighborhood of 50 years old. Lowe controls the Metro Pictures Corporation. The names of Marcus Lowe and Adolf Zukor are closely linked in the history of the movies. Both were in the fur business. Both were partners in the first penny arcade venture. Zukor went the way of pictures exclusively, although he later made investments in Lowe's enterprises. But Lowe went into variety and vaudeville of the type which is now to be found in the less desirable burlesque houses. From this he developed great entertainment enterprises which have made him a name and a fortune. The theaters he personally controls now number 105. At the head of the Goldwyn Film Corporation is Samuel Goldwyn, who is described as having been engaged along mercantile lines until motion pictures won his attention. In company with Jesse Lasky and Cecil B. DeMille, he organized a $20,000 corporation in 1912. In 1916, he had prospered so greatly that he organized a $20 million corporation with the Schuberts, A.H. Woods, and the Selwyns, the purpose of this latter company being to screen the works of prominent non-Jewish writers, a matter of which more will be said presently. The Universal Film Company, known everywhere through the name of Universal City, its studio headquarters, is under the control of Carl Lemle. It would seem from a reading of Who's Who that Lemle was his mother's name. His father's name is given as Julius Baruch. He is a Jew of German birth. He was manager of the Continental Clothing Company of Oshkosh until 1906, in which year he branched out into pictures, taking his first stand in a small Chicago motion picture theater. Lemley conceived the idea of fighting the trust, probably meaning the Edison Trust. He bought an enormous tract of land near Los Angeles and built Universal City as the headquarters of his production work. The Select Pictures Corporation is headed by Louis J. Selznick, who is also head of Selznick Pictures, Incorporated. He was at one time vice president of the World Film Corporation. With him are associated a number of members of his race. This is but to name a few. These are the official heads. Penetrate down through the entire organizations until you come to the last exhibition of the cracked and faded film in some cut-price theater in an obscure part of a great city, and you'll find that the picture business on its commercial side is Jewish through and through. In the above notes, reference has been made to the occupations out of which the present arbiters of photodramatic art have come to their present eminence. They are former newsboys, peddlers, clerks, variety hall managers, and ghetto products. It is not urged against any successful businessman that he formerly sold newspapers on the streets, or peddled goods door to door, or stood in front of a clothing store hailing passers-by to inspect his stock. That is not the point at all. The point is here. Men who come from such employments, with no gradations between, with nothing but a commercial vision of the show business, can hardly be expected to understand, or if they understand, to be sympathetic with, a view of the picture drama which includes both art and morality. Mr. Lemley, it will be remembered from a former article, said of his company, "The Universal does not pose as a guardian of public morals or of public taste." This is probably the attitude of other producers, too. But though they avoid any responsibility for taste or morals, they consistently fight all attempts of the state to set up a public guardianship in those regions. A business that frankly brutalizes taste and demoralizes morals should not be permitted to be a law unto itself.
Yeah, well, do you disagree or agree with that? I mean, do you think that, you know, they should be, you know, we should look to the morals in the community and not allow these people to just decide on their own what they can show and what they don't want to show because it's, you know, it's free enterprise or whatever?
I think that this is a serious flaw. It's not the only flaw, but it's a very serious flaw, maybe the most serious flaw, in our form of government, where the people elect their government, which is that the mass media remain in private hands, and they can end up being controlled by a particular interest group. There were movements to censor Hollywood films, and they eventually set up the Hays Commission or Hays Committee to set up standards for Hollywood to curb that so that they wouldn't have censorship.
The ACLU that you know, going back to that, that is always against censorship.
Yeah.
So they present it in a way that makes it seem like it's bad, but it's not really bad, I don't think. But you have to be the one who's in charge to decide so that your moral code is the one that's being followed. Anyway.
Yeah, I think distrust of government is really something that the Jews encourage. People, yeah. You know, this idea that the Jews want to establish a tyranny than a totalitarian state. I think that's wrong. Because even if they did, it would end up getting out of their hands and being a problem for them, which is what happened in the Soviet Union.
Okay.
It is very difficult to see how the Jewish leaders of the United States can evade the point that motion pictures are Jewish. And with this being true, there is the question of responsibility upon which they cannot very well be either impersonal or silent. The moral side of the movie's influence need not be discussed here because it is being discussed everywhere else. Everybody who has an active moral sense is convinced as to what is being done and as to what ought to be done. But the propaganda side of the movies does not so directly declare itself to the public. That the movies are recognized as a tremendous propagandist institution is proved by the eagerness of all sorts of causes to enlist them. It is also proved by the recent threat of a New York Gentile front that the movies themselves could prevent any progress being made in the attempt to save Sunday for the American people.
And so, you know, when they're putting Gentile front in quotes, this is the second time they use it, they're talking about Jewish interests that appear to be Gentile, right?
Some goy that speaks on the Jews' behalf.
Yeah, but is not identified as Jewish. Like, well, see,
or somebody that isn't Jewish would be a Gentile front.
Right.
Like George W. Bush or Barack Obama.
Right.
But who is the propagandist? Not the individual motion picture exhibitor on your street. He doesn't make the films. He buys his stuff as your grocer buys his canned goods and has a far narrower margin of choice. He has hardly any choice in the kind of pictures he shall show. In order to get any good pictures that may be distributed, he must take all of the other kind that may be distributed. He is the market of the film producers, and he must take the good with the bad or be cut off from getting any. As a matter of fact, with the movie bug so rampant in this country, it is next to impossible to supply enough good pictures for the stimulated and artificial demand. Some people's appetite calls for two or more pictures a day. If working people, they see a show at noon and several at night. If shallow-pated wives, they see several in the afternoon and several at night. With all the brains and the skill of the country engaged on the task, it would be impossible to supply a fresh drama of quality, hot out of the studios every hour, like bread. Where the Jewish controllers have overstepped themselves is here. They have overstimulated a demand which they are not able to supply, except with such material as is bound to destroy the demand.
Not really, because, you know, look at TV. I mean, there's still plenty of demand, and it's just garbage. But they have plenty of, they have turned stuff out for TV in the way that they're saying here.
Nothing is more dangerous to the motion picture business than the exaggerated appetite for them. And this appetite is whetted and encouraged until it becomes a mania. Like the saloon business, the movie business is killing itself by killing that quality in its customers on which it was built. Now, as to propaganda, there is evidence that the Jewish promoters have not overlooked that end of it. This propaganda, as at present observed, may be described under the following heads. It consists in silence about the Jew as an ordinary human being. Jews are not shown upon the stage, except in unusually favorable situations. Among the scenes offered the public, you will never see Hester Street or Lower Fifth Avenue at noontime. Recall if you have ever seen a large Jewish group scene on general exhibition. After a terrible fire in a clothing factory, that would probably be the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, the mayor of New York asked a certain motion picture company to prepare a film to be entitled The Locked Door, to show how buildings are turned into fire traps by ignorance and greed. The scenario was written by a fire official who knew the circumstances of many Holocausts.
Cool that they used that word before it was ever used, you know, for World War II. This is 1921. Yeah. They used it for big fires.
Yeah. Yeah, the most common use of that word in the 1970s was nuclear Holocaust.
Yeah, that's right.
During the course of the 80s, they gradually turned it into a proper noun, mm-hmm. and made it the property of the Jews. As most of the fire victims had been sweatshop girls, the scenario included a sweatshop. The picture was made as true to life as possible, so the head of the sweatshop was depicted as a Hebrew. The gentleman who told this incident to a committee of Congress said, "It was no discredit to the Hebrew race. We all know that they have been the fathers of the clothing industry. In fact, they made the first clothes." I don't think that's true. But all the same, the picture was declared taboo by Jewish leaders. It broke the cardinal rule of silence about the Jew, except when he could be depicted under exceptionally favorable circumstances. This ill-concealed propaganda of the Jewish motion picture control is also directed against non-Jewish religions. You never saw a Jewish rabbi depicted on the screen in any but a most honorable attitude. He is clothed with all the dignity of his office, and he is made as impressive as can be. Christian clergymen, as any movie fan will readily recall, were subjected to all sorts of misrepresentation, from the comic to the criminal. Now, that reminds me of what Marlon Brando said on Larry King's TV show about 20 years ago. He said, "From Hollywood, we see all these ethnic stereotypes, but we've never seen the kike. We've never seen the kike." Now, this attitude is distinctly Jewish, like many unlabeled influences in our life, whose sources lead back to Jewish groups. The object is to break down as far as possible all respectful or considerate thought about the clergy. The Catholic clergy very soon made themselves felt in opposition to this abuse of their priestly dignity. You never see a priest made light of on the screen. But the Protestant clergyman is still the elongated, sniveling, bilious hypocrite of anti-Christian caricature. More and more, the free love clergyman is appearing on the screen. He is made to justify his deeds by appeals to broad principles, which really kills two birds with one stone. It degrades the representative of religion in the eyes of the audience, and at the same time, it insidiously inoculates the audience with the same dangerous ideas. In the February Pictorial Review, Benjamin B. Hampton, a successful picture producer, throws a sidelight on this. He quotes a poster outside a movie show. The text says, "I refuse to live with you any longer. I denounce you as my wife. I will go to her, my free lover." Thus speaks the Reverend Frank Gordon in the greatest of all free love dramas. You may not depict a Hebrew as owner of a sweatshop, though all sweatshop owners are Hebrews. But you may make a Christian clergyman everything from a seducer to a safecracker and get away with it. There may be no connection whatever, but beholding what is done and remembering what is written in the protocols, a question arises. It is written, Shmuley.
We have misled, stupefied, and demoralized the youth of the Gentiles by means of education in principles and theories patently false to us, but which we have inspired.
Protocol 9.
We have taken good care long ago to discredit the Gentile clergy.
From Protocol 17.
It is for this reason that we must undermine faith, eradicate from the minds of the Gentiles the very principles of God and soul, and replace these conceptions by mathematical calculations and material desires.
From Protocol 4. Two possible views are open to choice. One, that this constant caricature of representatives of religion is simply the natural expression of a worldly state of mind. The other, that it is part of a traditional campaign of subversion. The former is the natural view among uninformed people. It would be the preferable view if peace of mind were the object sought. But there are far too many indications that the second view is justified to permit of its being cast aside. And of course, there is another view, which is the view of evolutionary psychology, which is, it supports the second view to some extent, but it's not all conscious calculation, according to evolutionary psychology.
Okay.
The screen.
Yeah, okay. I was trying to figure out where that fit in, but I kind of see it. All right.
Yeah. The screen, whether consciously or just carelessly, is serving as a rehearsal stage for scenes of antisocial menace. There are no uprisings of revolutions except those that are planned and rehearsed. That is the most modern fruit of the study of history, that revolutions are not spontaneous uprisings, but carefully planned minority actions. Revolution is not natural to the people, and is always a failure. There have been no popular revolutions. Civilization and liberty have been set back by those revolutions which subversive elements have succeeded in starting. But if you are to have your revolution, you must have a rehearsal. In England, the whole process of Sovietizing the country has been set forth on the stage, as in vivid object lessons. In this country, they have rehearsals by parades, by starting marches through factories and up to the offices, by importing lecturers who tell just how it was done in Russia, Hungary, and elsewhere. But it can be done better in the motion pictures than anywhere else. This is visual education, such as even the lowest brow can understand, and the lower the better.
Yeah,
indeed, there is a distinct disadvantage in being highbrow in such matters. Normal people shake their heads and pucker their brows and wring their hands and say, "We cannot understand it. We simply cannot understand it." Of course they cannot, but if they understood the low brow, they would understand it, and very clearly. There are two families in this world, and on one the darkness dwells.
Yeah, that's a good place to end. Well, folks, we're right out of time. We've got a few 6 or 7 paragraphs to go. We will do that next week. So do come back for the finale of this chapter.
Rage, 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 I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.